Take a network break, dunk a virtual donut in a nice hot cup of tea, and join us for the Packet Pushers weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Connery Murray. With me is Greg Farrow. It's going to be a shorter show this week. There's less to talk about, so we aren't going to pad things out. Before we get started, just a quick announcement about our sponsors. Today's show is sponsored in part by ExtraHop. They're the leader in real-time IT analytics. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. You can tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers to get a free t-shirt. And you can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself at extrahop.com/demo. Network Break is also sponsored by InterOptic. You can purchase high-performing optics at a fraction of the cost. Get more information at connect.interoptic.com/packetpushers. And tune into the Packet Pushers Weekly Show 360, where you can hear the CEO opine about transceivers, the Shannon limit, and the future of optics in the data center. And by the way, I don't know if you've noticed, but the Packet Pushers, we recently launched a new series called Briefings in Brief. This is something you have to subscribe to separately, but Greg, you can tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so Briefings in Brief is where vendors come and talk to us about their products, and we've discovered that blog posts are good for some people, but, you know, a quick 5-minute brain dump of what we learned from the vendor instead of a blog post, or in addition to, depending on how our time pans out, is a way to do it. So it's not part of the existing subscription. So if you're part of the Fat Pipe or any of the ganged up ones, we've decided to keep it separate so we don't overload your podcast feed.
That's right.
Because we might, depending, and we only publish when we've got something to say. Again, no point in saying we're going to publish every day when there's not things to say, because otherwise you start talking about pointless stuff. But, you know, it is possible for us to publish 2 or 3 a day and then do nothing for 10 days because there's nothing to talk to you about. So if you head on over to Packet Pushers, you'll find there's a new podcast, Briefings in Brief, and you need to subscribe to that separately in your Apple Podcasts app. If you just go in and type Briefings Packet Pushers, and you'll see Packet Pushers as a company, you'll see all the different feeds that we have in the thing.
I think we're up to 16 episodes at the moment. And by brief, we mean brief. The goal is to keep it under 5 minutes. It's basically a rundown of interesting highlights that came out of vendor briefings that we get, or analyst reports we read, or other things that catch our eye. But the goal is to keep it short, sharp, and informative.
Yeah, and we're trying to get vendors, so they often brief us with these decks that have lots of really good information, and we're trying to get them to give us the decks to put there so you can download it and get the background too, which would be great. So you can actually have the PDFs that they give to us so you can check and make your own interpretation on what they tell us, just in case you think we're lying or misinterpreting, which is great.
Or form your own opinions, yes.
Form your own opinions. I mean, that's, you know, we're trying to summarize it for you so you can find the little diamond and maybe something's relevant to you. So, you know, if vendors just let us give you the deck, we will give it to you.
That's right. All right, enough cross promotion. It's time for the news. Amazon's reInvent conference wrapped up last week and Amazon flooded the zone. There was a torrent of announcements. And to me, it almost felt like a show of force, like a message to Microsoft and Google. You're never going to catch up with us. You can't keep up.
You know, we've criticized VMware and Cisco for this, so I'm going to criticize this torrent of useless information. You know, just there's just so much of it that you can't talk about any of it.
It's a huge dump.
At best, I think there was like 54 separate product announcements or something like that.
It was an insane amount.
It's pointless, like, just because it's such an ego ride for the people who organize the conference, or for the executives who stand up and feel like they're, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it, basically, it's like having diarrhea one day and then being constipated for the rest of for the next 6 months. It's pointless, right? Anyway, let's go over some highlights that we dug out and see if we can find some diamonds in the dross.
All right. So one thing that jumped out to me was Amazon getting on the Kubernetes train. In one way they did that, they announced that their Elastic Container Service now officially supports Kubernetes. We all know Kubernetes is sort of becoming the de facto orchestration platform for containers, and folks have been running Kubernetes on AWS, but now it's official on their Elastic Container Service.
Yeah, it is indeed. And that's really interesting. I think what they've done here is lots of people have been thinking that Amazon's response has to make a response to containers. Kubernetes has been getting lots and lots of airtime. People are saying this is the future of containers. It's not about running containers on a VM or whatever. And in a sense, AWS hasn't sort of done anything or said what they're going to do. And everybody's been wondering. And the Google Cloud and even Azure's announced support for Kubernetes. What really has happened is, from my reading of this, is that AWS has jumped over Kubernetes and said, don't worry about an orchestration platform. You just ask for a container and you'll get one. So
right.
You know, when Kubernetes is a whole orchestration platform to do this, you know, you can do AWS's. Effectively, it becomes a proprietary version of Kubernetes to some extent, in the sense that their orchestration system becomes invisible to you. You don't need to deploy Kubernetes to orchestrate containers. You can just instantiate containers. So I don't know if customers will like this. If you're all in with AWS, it's like, you know, being all in with Microsoft or, you know, all in with IBM from 30 years ago. The deeper and deeper you get into the AWS ecosystem, the more and more you're locked into their stuff. But the flip side of it is that setting up a Kubernetes cluster manager or a Docker swarm is actually a significant task. It's not something that you do without having to go off and develop skills. And this AWS Fargate means you just click a button and containers arrive and they're orchestrated by AWS. So dumb customers will do dumb things. And so a simplified container system is going to be very popular for dumb customers. There's no shortage for dumb customers, as we know.
Yeah. And you're referring to a separate announcement they made called Fargate, which is a container service, which lets you run a container just like you would a VM. And you don't have worry at all about the underlying infrastructure. So it's like EC2, but instead of a VM, it's a container. You just go in there, you say, I'm using a container. You specify the CPU, you specify the memory. They handle all the underlying infrastructure and off you go.
But you can still use Kubernetes. So they have the ECS, Elastic Container Service, so you can put a Kubernetes instance and you can use Amazon's containers. They're not excluding you from it.
Right.
But they're sort of offering their own version of it so that if you don't want to learn how to run Kubernetes, you can run a cluster of containers. And
I think
so
that's
forth.
What's going on. Yeah. If you're a Kubernetes shop and you like it, then they give you an option. If you just want to stick all Amazon, then Fargate may be the way to go.
Sure. Now, obviously, the purpose here is to disrupt Kubernetes. I don't think that AWS wants to see Google get all the running here and be able to define the future container, because it's not the container itself. It's the orchestration of the containers. And Kubernetes is far superior to the Fargate product in a lot of ways. But, you know, if you don't want to deal with the hassle of setting up the container orchestrator and then having a resource, you know, having to maintain some skills around container orchestration, this takes away. But in the time-honored tradition of AWS, this product is really shipping early and it's shipping defectively, in my opinion. It's missing a bunch of features. So a lot of the people have been going, oh, AWS Fargate. And then people have been going, oh, for example, the security model is completely broken because everything that's in a VPC is a shared space. You can't isolate containers inside of a single VPC, which leaves you, if you want to implement some security, you have to have multiple VPCs today. Now, I'm sure that in 6 months or a year or 2 years, they will fix this and, you know, add features and all that sort of stuff. So you need to just, you know, hold your breath, and I wouldn't rush into this because there's going to be a fair bit of, if customers start to use it, there's going to be a fair bit of iteration to put in the missing features. The flip side of this is that people who were previously looking at Kubernetes are now going to be going like, oh, maybe we should just use Fargate and not have to have Kubernetes in our organization, and we can pay, you know, over the odds for AWS to do the orchestration for us.
Sure. It's worked for AWS so far.
Yes.
Another announcement that came out is you can now run on bare metal inside AWS.
So I think there's a couple of interesting things about this bare metal. Is obviously the thing there is that they're just saying we've got bare metal servers and you can now buy them by the hour, day, week, month, year, whatever. And that is a real turnaround because up until now it's always been software only, blah, blah, blah. This actually has some fairly interesting impacts. I think there's two key ones. There's no reason to talk about the technology other than say, you know, renting bare metal servers is an interesting idea. And we've gotten better at being able to provision servers remotely over the years. And AWS has obviously been doing bare metal provisioning for some time, and they've just turned an existing service into a commercial product. So think about the impact of that. But I think that bare metal means that colo providers are going to be in trouble because they're going to have to seriously up their game. Like if you're renting a bare metal server in a colo facility today, and you have to physically go there to set it up and get it running, well, now these existing colo facilities are going to have to start doing grown-up services, like be innovative and invest money in building bare metal orchestration systems. And if you are going into a colo data center, like traditionally, you know, where you go and buy, you know, 200 square meters and sign up for a five-year contract, well, Amazon's just disrupted that business quite badly.
Which they're very good at.
Yeah. Well, you see, normally when you go into a colo, you have to buy, you know, I'm going to rent 500 square meters of space over the next 10 years. I may only need 200 square meters today, but I have to have growth as I grow out.
Right.
Well, this bare metal gives you everything that you get from a colo with none of the wasted money on day one. It's going to be pricey, of course, but, you know, increasingly enterprise IT is reluctant to sign up to these five-year contracts of fixed cost, and they just want to pay what they want to pay. A saving this year is better than a saving in year four as a rule. So, yeah, and it also just struck me, you know, we know that the VMware over AWS has been delayed a bit. Like, remember we talked about this 6 months ago and it was supposed to happen almost immediately? And you do got to wonder if VMware over at AWS delays have been related to this product, the bare metal provisioning, because keep in mind that VMware on AWS is bare metal provisioned.
That's right. You had to actually get the whole server if you're going to run your VMware stack in AWS.
And, you know, I know how big companies work and stupid is the normal. I could just see that we're not going to let this other product shipped until we get our bare metal provisioning product shipped because we want to iterate and change it. You know, we aren't rushing it all out the door and then, you know what I mean? So
that's right.
You got to. I wonder if some of the VMware on AWS troubles might be linked to this product. But now it's out the door, maybe VMware can get their deployment stuff working a bit further, a bit faster, a bit quicker.
All right, one more on the Amazon AWS reInvent. They also announced inter-region VPC peering. And here's a quote from Amazon on what that means. It allows VPC resources like EC2 instances to run in different AWS regions to communicate with each other using private IP addresses without requiring gateways, VPN connections, or separate network appliances. So with this new capability, that means your traffic between regions, it all stays on the AWS backbone in encrypted tunnels.
So this is a really big deal. Those of you who are building data center interconnect, you can now actually have a VPC talking to another VPC, and you can do your legacy style redundancy. So instead of building resilient apps, which is, you know, the cloud ready model, where over here is your VMs in one region and your VMs in another region can only ever have different IP addresses, now you can build them just like they're running on the same VLAN. That's basically what it means. And you don't need to put in VPN gateways and the cost of all that. Now, quite honestly, configuring a VPN in AWS was fairly traumatic, so avoiding that is quite a good idea. So this is a good thing for users. It does now let enterprises with existing apps, makes it easier for them to just come and dump them into AWS as is. So they pick up a VM on your existing, maybe on your VMware or whatever, and then just take them over to AWS and dump them in. And that's going to be very interesting because now you've got a DCI between different regions and you can start doing replication of data and all that sort of stuff in the way that you're used to doing it today. But some words of caution from my initial reading, just remember that replicating data and IP addresses and VMs is usually not a good idea. But I also believe that most people will say, oh, we don't have to do any work and it's cheap just to keep our apps the way they are. So this makes it like easier for you to move to AWS, even when it's stupid to do it. You shouldn't take your legacy apps into AWS. That's what I just wanted to say about that. Inter-region VPC does actually sort of give AWS on par.
That's interesting. I'm sure Amazon is doing everything they can to make their space available for legacy applications without having to do any refactoring, without having to rethink how you're designing the application. And so enabling that kind of lift and shift ease of use, I guess, makes sense certainly for Amazon's perspective. If I was thinking about moving into the cloud, of course, I would want to think about cloud native and how I'm actually designing the application to run and function. But you know, everybody makes their own choices.
Mm. Let me just take some general observations about the whole AWS announcement suite. And, you know, there's a link in the show notes to the list of all the blogs that they announced at reInvent. So you can go and read them all yourself. But, you know, in the past, we would have normally seen our legacy IT vendors ship just a few of these features in 1 year and then send out the salespeople to go and shove them down customers' throats and get money and sit back and relax and take the money in, you know, and they would basically have just done nothing until some customers have bought them to see which ones are successful. And yet what AWS seems to be doing is just continuing to bring features to market at a pace that just continues to surprise me. There's no slowdown here.
Right. Yeah, as I mentioned at the top, it's just rolls and rolls and rolls.
Yeah. So normally the big vendors sort of run on these 3-year product cycles when they, you know, they spend 3 years working on a product, they ship it, and then they do nothing to it for 3 years. And then, you know, they get all constipated with feature requests and customer requirements, and then they poop out a new one. And again, it's, you know, years of selling and getting the money back from it. Whereas AWS is just going, no, let's just keep building features, roll them out, roll them out, roll them out. This really sort of changes my perspective on these legacy IT vendors. I'm just using legacy to say they're not AWS. It's not a criticism, but increasingly looking in defective in their business models in terms of product pacing, product development, and progress, right? If AWS can bring these features to market at this pace, when will we see private clouds that compete with this? When will we see private clouds that have these capabilities on-prem? Or have those, you know, what sort of businesses will our IT vendors have if AWS can continue to release product features at this rate? And then obviously the third conclusion is, what sort of jobs will we have if you're working inside of enterprise IT? What sort of jobs will you have in 10 years' time if AWS continues to release features that makes your existing enterprise IT infrastructure just so unfunctional or not have the features that you want or whatever? Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And I think that is a fair point to raise and people should be considering it.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about things like, you know, other parts of the show where we talk about SD-WAN and we talk about segment routing and how to build, you know, end-to-end networks and all that sort of stuff. And I'm sort of, you just look at some of the things that Amazon's doing and you're going like, I can understand why people aren't bothering.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Just move it to AWS and be done. You know,
exactly.
It's all there and all I have to, you know, why would I? And I really think the vendors have to like pick up their game and show this, that they've got a competitive reaction to this and not just sort of, oh, we'll let you connect your legacy to AWS and make it easier for you to move to AWS. I think, you know, why aren't they fighting this?
That ease of use, that continuing feature deployment, that frictionless purchase mechanism, and the ease of getting information up into the cloud, really, I agree with you, does lay out a gauntlet for legacy IT vendors to say, how are you going to react to this? How are you stepping up?
Maybe it's just this week because they just released so many products and so many. I mean, they released artificial intelligence engines. They released Alexa for Business. I mean, oh, no, I do not want to. Can you imagine Alexa monitoring every conversation in an office? And, you know, and they announced machine learning platforms and IoT and all this other stuff. And it's like, just how are these vendors going to produce products that you can deploy on-prem? You know, and have our existing vendors just given up? Are they really just waiting for the existing businesses to die? Or what, you know, what are they doing to make this, you know, make on-prem work?
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. There's maybe I just feel a bit overwhelmed today, this week, because of all the AWS announcements.
But it's just, we're reeling a little bit.
Yeah. Maybe it's just this week. Maybe next week will be fine.
That's right. All right, moving on. Juniper stocks jumped almost 20% last week when CNBC, citing unnamed sources, said Nokia was planning an acquisition offer worth $16 billion. But it seemed like almost seconds after the CNBC story broke, Nokia released a statement saying, quote, Nokia is not currently in talks with, nor is it preparing an offer for Juniper Networks related to an acquisition of that company. That was pretty much it.
Yeah, and that's the entire blog post. That's
that was the shortest, most clear press release I have ever read from a tech vendor, frankly.
I think it took about 16 hours or 24 hours for it to come out. As soon as I saw the tweet, I just went, this doesn't make sense. And CNBC is not normally a source to which you pay much attention to when it comes to.
Now we have another reason.
Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to enterprise IT and stock markets, CNBC is not normally a media outlet. So I was like, keep in mind. And the instant I thought about that, I Googled it up and remembered that Nokia paid $16 billion for Alcatel-Lucent just a few years back, 2012, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that gave them all the IP networking that they would ever need. So buying Juniper for $16 billion just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you know, just doesn't pass the sort of, you know.
Right. This is just a baseless suspicion. I wonder if someone was maybe trying to game the system to do a little stock trading manipulation. And so they got somebody at CNBC to run with a story that wasn't very properly sourced. I don't know. Again, all speculation, but the lightning speed with which this came out, the stock jumped. There's a lot of transactions going on in the market around this. And then Nokia denies it. Stock goes back to essentially where it was at the start. It seems a little fishy to me, but again, I've been poking around on the internet trying to find evidence. I haven't found anything, but it's a very strange turn.
Yeah, I just feel that somebody at CNBC got a hold of it, thought they'd got a sort, you know, maybe they, who knows, maybe just was a junior, but I wouldn't be trusting the CNBC to talk about enterprise IT and technology stocks, really. That was the first flag for me right there.
Mm. Yeah, always check the source. All right, anyway, so Nokia is not buying Juniper. We can all move on. Quick break to tell you about ExtraHop. They are the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data. That is the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment. That's the data center, the edge, the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For a long time, IT has thought of the network as either plumbing or a problem. But with ExtraHop, the network becomes the biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does analysis first and then stores packets, which creates wired data encompassing all interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective, and analyzing it at scale transforms the network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. ExtraHop has customers like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, Netflix. It's helped them save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times by more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. You can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself when you go to extrahop.com/demo. And if you connect with them on Twitter at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers, that'll get you a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT.
Yeah, just to jump on that, I had an interesting conversation with the CTO of ExtraHop a few months back, and he was telling me that ExtraHop will still be relevant when TLS 1.3, you know, even though they can still get quite a lot of analytics and intelligence even when the flow is encrypted, which I thought was interesting. And he had a really compelling story that sort of convinced me that this was going to be happening. So even it's definitely got a future as far as I can see.
Okay.
Just some observations there. I was thinking about TLS 1.3 again this week.
as people are wont to do, just going about their daily business thinking about TLS 1.3.
Indeed. Aren't you?
No, I'm not. Maybe that's my fault. I've got to up my game. All right. We were just speaking a little bit about Amazon. Security researchers discovered a publicly available Amazon S3 storage bucket happened to contain classified information from the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. That is a joint command between the Army and the NSA. That is not good.
You know, I think somewhere out there on the internet, there's a website that says S3 storage vulnerability of the day or you know, data found of the day. Because,
sure.
I mean, the fact that this has happened, we've heard this so many times, but the thing that strikes me about this is how much we have exactly the same problems in the cloud that we actually have inside of our existing data centers today.
Exactly.
Have you ever thought about that?
It's, you know, you're exactly right. It's the basic human stuff about eating your security vegetables when you're leaving a storage system publicly available. You have failed in your identity and access management.
No, it's just, these people are having exactly the same problems. The thing is, though, that in the cloud, it's actually easier to find because people are just scanning S3 buckets.
That's right.
And so really, what we're actually seeing here is that the same problems that happened in the enterprise are actually worse in the cloud, but nobody's actually talking about that. Because, you know, everybody likes to be really positive about AWS and say how awesome it is instead of being a little bit more brutally realistic. So, you know.
Well, I feel like it's not necessarily Amazon's fault. They give you the tools to set up some basic security structures, including identity and access management controls. It's up to customers to use them.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And people are doing stupid stuff like, you know, using public GitHub servers to hold the keys so that it makes it easy to cruise into S3, you know, and stuff like this. But those are exactly the same problems we have in enterprise IT. So the things that people are saying is, you know, we found an open FTP server or we had a firewall rule which let people, it was the web server. That's exactly the same. But the fact that this data is all in the same place with an S3 bucket actually makes it easier for people to find your data because they just have to use one tool and they just let it scan until it finds an open S3 bucket and starts to have a look at what's in there, right?
That's right.
It's actually easier to hack this because it's in the cloud than it would be if it was in a private data center. But nobody wants to talk about that. But hey, what do I know?
There it is. All right, moving on. Worldwide server revenues jumped almost 20% year over year in the third quarter of 2017. That is according to IDC. Servers brought in $17 billion in the third quarter.
So IDC, of course, is the analyst firm that likes to count stuff and it's prognostications, really. They have like guesses, pretending that it's based on something in reality. But the fact that it jumped, server sales jumped 20%, actually doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not counterintuitive to the narrative that we've got in that, you know, server sales are shrinking because most of it's moving into the public cloud. So I was a bit surprised at that.
Yeah, their take is that they're seeing some more enterprise action where all of the heat had been around cloud scale providers, which was hurting folks like Dell and HPE. Now it seems like enterprises are maybe doing some infrastructure refresh, and so that's pumping up sales.
Yeah, so the thing that's happening here is that server buying cycles, especially when you're talking about whole of market, are highly dependent on the silicon release cycle. So there was a whole bunch of updates that Intel released around Skylake and Purley and blah, blah, blah. And we've seen a whole jump into FPGAs and blah, blah, blah. So I think there was a slowdown as people realized there's a new generation. So people said, well, we'll back off our purchases and wait for the good fancy silicon to arrive, which is bad for Intel because that actually causes their share price to have conniptions, right?
To go in trough and wave, yeah.
Yeah, to get, you know, because if once we know that the next generation of CPU is coming, people are actually going to start really slowing down their purchases ahead of a release, and then we're going to have this big demand when the new thing comes on. So I think we're going to see less pre-announcements from Intel, a lot more doubling down on secrecy in the sense that so that markets don't slow down their purchases of the old stuff,
which is good. Right.
Because what's good for customers isn't good for the vendor, as a rough rule.
We got to get these things out the door. Don't talk about the new stuff.
I want money this month, not next quarter. It doesn't solve my budget. It doesn't get my executive bonus this month. If we delay it. So I think what you're seeing here is that driven by silicon sales. Just a reminder that all the cloud in the world, it's all still silicon.
That's right. And just a quick rundown on the leaders, HPE and its H3C partner at the top of the standings, they've got 19.5% of the market share. Dell Inc. is in second place with 18% of the market share. IBM and Cisco are statistically tied for third. This is all according to IDC. Quick note, ODMs, those are the original device manufacturers, they saw the biggest jump in revenue compared to 2016 with growth of 45.3%. So those are the folks selling directly to the hyperscale teams.
50% growth in a year. Wow.
Yeah, if I was Dell and HP, I'd be worried.
Yeah, but interesting to see that Dell came in second. That's got to be a bit. It'd be interesting to know how much profit Dell made compared to whether it's just want leadership by dollar or leadership by profit would be an interesting discussion to have. Well, we won't know anymore, of course.
That's right.
Well, let's take a moment to thank our second sponsor for today's show, Interoptic. Now, people tend to buy your SFP modules and your transceivers from the vendor who made the hardware that you use, right? Because you've always been told that if you buy anybody else's, that God will kill a kitten, right? But the reality is you have legitimate options for optics, and no kittens have to die. Interoptic loves kittens, and they think that there are optics that you will want to buy. You can purchase the same, if not better, performing optics designed by engineers who understand what you need, and they understand optics and SFPs at a fraction of the cost of what a vendor will sell it to you for. So take control of your optics purchase and have Interoptic stand behind the optics they sell you, and they'll give you a better price. And just a note here, the SFP modules have code that needs to be updated. In fact, there's little chips inside the SFP modules, and there's firmware. And if you update them, then your vendor equipment will recognize them as genuine optics. That way you don't get alarms coming off the kit saying non-offend approved and all that sort of stuff. And it also means if that firmware is right, then it'll actually operate at the optimum for that equipment. Sometimes the vendors tweak the optics a little bit for their own environments or do some minor hacks to get pseudo improvements or to add value. Well, Interoptic knows how to research and make that code for you. So as you're seeing more demand for all of the optics around the data center, and so you can have the same optics everywhere, barring just a firmware update, you can start thinking about how you're going to do that. Interoptic understands you're going to need to be more nimble at layer zero, and they support a full range of products that you need today and don't yet know you need tomorrow. From a hut in the Arctic Circle to the battlefield in Iraq, Interoptic has more than 4,000 customers across 7 continents. Well, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
Visit connect.interoptic.com/packetpushers and contact them directly to get a quote. And you can follow them on the socials as @getinterconnect. Again, that's connect.interoptic.com/packetpushers. And if you use that link, that would be great because then they'll know that you came from us. And thanks to Interoptic for being a sponsor and helping us out.
All right, we're going to wrap up with a couple of financial stories and a surfing dog. Hyperconverged company Nutanix released their quarterly financials. They posted revenues of $275 million for the quarter, which is a 46% jump over last year. The company also said it ended the quarter with almost 8,000 end customers.
Yeah, so good for Nutanix. They're continuing to grow well. And as I've said before, I actually think that they've got an impressive sort of product portfolio. Remember what I just said earlier about how do we make private clouds look useful?
I was just thinking about that, yeah, and Nutanix is one of the folks thinking about that.
That's exactly right. I did note, however, and part of what made me amused is the level of bombast that's coming from the company is really quite astonishing. I'll read you a quote that I took from somewhere. We now have an iPhone-like design patent that people could touch and feel and the channel could sell. Customers love us for bringing the web-scale culture in which white box with robust software. It is a world-class customer service and meaningfully more delightful than the current experience of stitching together vendors.
Wow.
And having teams that constantly finger point at each other. Now, this is the Nutanix CEO. Now, quite honestly, I do think Nutanix has got a product, but the level of bombast is just hysterical. And really, I do think that if they want to be taken seriously, they do need to step it down a notch. So while I do think that they're making a great product and they are sort of showing the way forward here, I do think they need to get a grip on reality. The other key note from their from the transcript from what they when they were talking to shareholders is that they said, and this one's a kicker, Nutanix would have recorded nearly $800 million in pure software and support billings and delivered gross margins above 80%. Now, that's if they took all the hardware sales, so if they just stopped selling hardware and they went on inside of that transcript to start talking about – remember we talked about bare metal on AWS?
Mm-hmm.
They said, very interesting to us because we could actually start running our platform on bare metal in those clouds. Think about that. So that's very interesting. I just – so good – well done for Nutanix. Great revenue growth, great things. But I do get amused by the self-belief and the self-delusion of just how awesome they are.
Well, here's something they're not being very bombastic about. Despite the revenue growth, they still had a net loss of $61.5 million. So not profitable yet.
Not profitable, and they're spending too much on selling. So they are getting results, but what they're doing is blowing it on salespeople. So they have a massive sales force out there making sure that, you know, that they get the purchase orders and ask customers for purchase orders and make sure that customers are writing purchase orders. Salespeople are expensive, like really, really expensive. And that's literally where it is.
But Wall Street also loves growth, so I think they'll be fine.
Yes, well, it's the Amazon story. As long as you're growing, that's fine.
Right. Profits, schmoffits.
Yeah, profits are optional as long as you're growing.
That's right. All right, VMware.
Until it stops growing, then it all comes tumbling down.
That's when
that's
you pay the
piper. That's why the bombast is not a good idea.
All right, VMware announced results for their fiscal third quarter. The company posted revenues of $1.98 billion, which is up 11% from last year. VMware also had net income of $443 million for the quarter.
Yeah, good results for VMware. Their business is still growing. Two years ago, we were sort of saying that VMware is going to run out of steam with the ESX vSphere model, and they're doing great. So no reason to believe they're not going to continue to grow. Compare that with, you know, HPE and Cisco and IBM, whose businesses are shrinking fairly solidly. I think there's something to be said about a software-focused business. Keep in mind that VMware is actually quite a bit smaller than those businesses too, by the way.
Well, that's I keep forgetting about how fiscally small they are compared to some of these people. The quarterly revenue of under $2 billion, that's not a lot in the industry they're playing in. And yet their influence is more outsized than the money they're actually bringing in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, $2 billion a quarter, that means they're an $8 billion company. Cisco's sort of doing like $50 billion, $48 billion a year.
Yeah, $40, $50
billion,
yeah.
So, you know, a point of perspective. But VMware is still growing, and whereas all the other companies are shrinking. I just think there's something to be learned from that.
All right, for our Surfing Dog segment, Snapchat CEO Evan Spiegel took to Axios to write about how the company plans to combine human moderators and algorithms to, I guess, make your Snapchat feed better. I don't really know what's going on.
So Snapchat is basically saying people don't want to have their feeds hacked up together, right?
Hacked up by by Facebook manipulating.
Well, so what Facebook does is Facebook's algorithm not only focuses on what you talk about, but it takes into account all the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
So if your friend is a Trump supporter, then you are automatically a Trump supporter, right? Mm-hmm. Now, whether you are or aren't, you know, or you know, maybe you like, you know, wearing furry costumes to conferences, or maybe your friend does and you don't, you know, but.
So you're thinking, why are all these furries in my Facebook feed?
And it's because one of your friends is a furry, you know? So what they're saying is that people actually don't want to be classified or analyzed or pigeonholed by the people that they are friend with. So Snapchat's saying it's not about the social, it's about the communication.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think that's really, really interesting. That's effectively an anti-Facebook and anti-Google move. So this whole Facebook, like even if you don't have a Facebook account, Facebook still has a shadow profile about you. And it takes, or Google as well, right? Even if you don't use Google Mail, Google still has all the emails that were ever sent to you by people that sent them to you. So they still know about you and can make stuff about you. So,
not to mention your searches, your Android phone, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think this is a very interesting move. Two things. Snapchat is not a Silicon Valley company. It's actually based out of Los Angeles. So they can do things differently, and they don't live in the Silicon Valley bubble. And secondly, if this works as a business model in terms of – so if subscriber counts start to rise and engagement starts to rise and shows that an anti-Facebook type approach can work, we might actually see some adult behavior. I think ultimately that will follow with startups and investors, which would be a good thing.
That would be a good thing. Adult behavior is always welcome.
Especially when it comes to social media, it's well overdue.
Not that I'm a Snapchat user, I have aged out of that particular platform.
Yeah, but I think that if this takes off, it could actually flow through and into other things like Twitter and so forth, where there's much more perspective about what people want out of communication tools.
I mean, certainly they have to find a way to distinguish themselves. They are not doing anywhere near as well as Facebook. They are tiny, almost, I can't say insignificant, but tiny compared to Facebook and the money that Facebook is making. Snapchat's struggling a bit. So obviously the CEO is coming on to a platform like Axios and throwing some shade at Facebook and saying, we've got a whole different idea and we're going to make it great. I guess I felt like it was also a little, maybe they're going to crack this. I don't know. But it felt to me just a little bit like Facebook wrecked the country by promoting bogus stories and we would never do that. And we're great. And
Well, at least it's something that Facebook can't copy. Like every time Facebook does something,
true,
Facebook just copies it.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah, yeah.
This is absolutely something that Facebook can't copy because it's their whole business model is based around the, you know, squeezing like a level of surveillance capitalism that just boggles the mind. So yeah, I just thought it was worth mentioning that there is a trend here to actually start an anti-Facebook movement sort of emerging where. And if it's successful as a business, this could be something to be watching out for.
All right, keep an eye on that. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me on my blog at Ethereal Mind. I am doing stuff on the Twitters. I tweet technically as at Ethereal Mind, and I tweet snarkily as at Greg J. Farrow. That's where I really have my main conversations. I'm also trying to put more on LinkedIn, but so you can follow me there. If you're a recruiter, don't follow me there. I will just block you.
All right.
I'm tired of being harassed by recruiters.
I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, where I do all of my tweeting, snark or not, in one slick little package. I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, Interoptic and ExtraHop. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please tell other people, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes. That really helps. And check out our membership program. That's at packetpushers.net/members. It's free to sign up. You get Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation, and maybe some exclusive member content. And also don't forget Google Briefings and Brief Packet Pushers and see if you like what we're doing there. Thanks for listening.